Do you people want ants? Because this is how you get ants. By listening to Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com.
Real smooth.
Thank you. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me as always is the Louise to my Scott Lang.
Mike DiCrescio.
If you've never listened to an episode of Film Bookcast before, essentially we begin by talking about some film news, and then we move on into our discussion segment of the show, in which Mike and I each discuss whatever piece of media we've been consuming lately. And then finally, we will move on to our featured review. This week, we're reviewing Ant-Man, the latest film from director Peyton Reed, and the 12th film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So with that all said, let's kick off the show with some film news. Mike, are you ready to start?
Yes, let's go on.
Good, I'm glad you're ready.
You know. I come to this totally unprepared.
That's how we fun. Like it. We wing it. Yeah. We wing this.
Exactly. All right.
So we have a couple of things for film news. The first one, I kind of wanted to briefly mention. So Comic-Con was this past week.
Yes.
And there wasn't as much big news that came out of that as I expected. You know, yeah. We discussed last episode the Phil Lord and Chris Miller doing the Han Solo spinoff thing. Otherwise, right. You know, not too much. I mean, Lucasfilm had their panel. They had, like, a nice thing going on, but there wasn't really much news. Marvel didn't have a panel. Right. So, and there was a couple trailers that came out, like Batman vs. Superman and Suicide Squad, but we're not watching trailers. Although,
that's right.
Although, I'll be honest, I did watch those trailers.
You son of a bitch. I did just see the Batman vs. Superman one, though.
Yes.
Which is awesome.
Yeah,
I saw that before Ant-Man.
Yes. Yeah, it looks, I mean, I'm actually, here's the thing, Man of Steel also had great trailers.
That's true.
And that movie was the worst, so, you know.
I don't know, this one looks really awesome, this trailer, compared to the last one.
Yeah, I think this trailer looks a lot better than the last one. And Suicide Squad, I guess you didn't see, but it...
I haven't seen yet.
I'm of two minds about, but I think it has some interesting things going on in it, in any case. But I just wanted to briefly mention that, but really what I wanted to talk about, Quentin Tarantino had a panel at Comic-Con discussing The Hateful Eight, his upcoming movie, and he announced at this panel that Ennio Morricone... a legendary film composer who scored films like The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, is going to be composing the score for Quentin Tarantino's The Hateful Eight.
Everything I hear about this movie just gets better and better.
Yeah. Yeah, can you say film nerd boner? Like, that's...
Yeah, seriously.
This is going to be Morricone's first Western in 40 years, which is nuts. I mean, his score is like a staple of spaghetti Westerns of the 60s. Yeah. And he's been a huge influence on Quentin Tarantino. Tarantino has had Ennio Morricone tracks from other movies in his own movies. There's an Ennio Morricone track in Kill Bill. There's one in Inglourious Basterds. I think Ennio Morricone actually composed a new one for Django Unchained, but he didn't do the whole score. He just did, like, one song.
Right.
And also, this is going to be the first time, I'm pretty sure, that Quentin Tarantino has a movie with a score in it.
Yeah, usually it's just pop songs.
Yeah, usually it's like a mixtape of various songs. And so... this is going to be, I think, pretty nuts. Like, I'm pretty excited.
This is going to be nuts. I mean, I heard, what was it? I think somebody said that they like, keep, because it's supposed to take place in the winter in somewhere in the West, and he, like, froze the sound stage that they were using to film on. Like, he did, like, so they were actually cold.
Really?
It's like I was like, that's the most Quentin Tarantino thing I've ever heard. But I don't know. It just seems like it's going to be a really awesome movie.
Yeah.
I hope.
Yeah, so I wanted to mention that briefly because I think that's a really cool bit of trivia, and I'm very excited for The Hateful Eight. Like, you know, there was a time when this movie was not going to be made,
right?
Because the script leaked, and Tarantino was like, "Well, I don't want to do this anymore because everybody has read it." Luckily, he changed his mind. I've actually read about the first 10 pages of the script. Not that I had the script, like, not that I downloaded it myself, but I had a friend who, when Tarantino
went, quote unquote.
When Tarantino announced that he wasn't making the movie, it was essentially like, well, we might as well read the script now.
Right. That's a good point.
And so my friend had gotten the script from somebody, and he sent me a copy of the script in an email. And I only read like the first 10 pages because I was holding out hope that he would change his mind and make the movie.
Right.
And he did.
He listened to your wishes,
He listened
Mike.
To my wish. This movie exists because of me,
because
really.
Solely...
Yeah.
Thank you, Mike.
You're welcome. You're welcome. But I've read the first 10 pages, like, over a year ago, and I can tell you that they were pretty good.
All right. So, good to know.
So, in any case, I just wanted to bring that up. I'm very excited for The Hateful Eight, and Ennio Morricone scoring it is just icing on the cake, I think. And also, one last bit of news. The Emmy nominations came out this past week. I actually watched them announce the Emmy nominations, which I have never done before.
Really?
Because usually they're at like 5:30 in the morning.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
This year they had them at a decent hour. They aired at 12:30 p.m. On the eastern side, and so they announced it. They had Uzo Aduba from Orange is the New Black and mm-hmm. somebody else I can't remember announcing the awards.
Very memorable.
Announcing the nominations. Yeah, I mean it was like 5 minutes and they just like, listing off names. So
right.
You know, it's whatever.
Yeah.
In any case, here are the Emmy nominations for Best Drama. There's Better Call Saul, Downton Abbey, Game of Thrones, Homeland, House of Cards, Mad Men, and Orange is the New Black. So, of those series, Mike, what do you think is the... What would you like to see win?
I would like to see Better Call Saul win.
Okay. Yeah, I was actually... I was curious about Better Call Saul's Emmy possibilities. Yeah, the Emmys always nominated Breaking Bad for stuff, but Better Call Saul is such a different show. I wasn't sure if it would, you know, fit into their criteria. But, you know, I think it's kind of just slotted into the slot where Breaking Bad used to be.
Yeah, you know? And even, like, in its, like, the actual show itself, it is just, it's such a successor to Breaking Bad style and everything that I'm in love.
Yeah, no, I love Better Call Saul, and I'm excited for it. Of those shows, I want to see Mad Men take it.
Okay.
Mad Men has won Best Drama 4 times before.
So I'm sure it's gonna.
Well, it won for its first 4 seasons, and then it lost.
And then Breaking Bad started?
No, actually, what happened was the first 4 seasons, Mad Men and Breaking Bad started around the same time, actually.
Did they really?
Yeah. And so,
the more you know.
First 4 seasons of Mad Men won Best Drama, and then it lost in its 5th season to Homeland in its first season.
Oh, that's right.
And then, after that, Breaking Bad won 2 years in a row for mm-hmm. For both halves of its 5th season.
Right.
And now, it's today. Now we're in today times, and you know this is Mad Men's last chance to win. It's going to be its final because it was its final season, final half of its final season. And I'd like to see it just take it one more time because its final season was amazing. And really, I was a little annoyed that Mad Men was losing in those last couple of years because it was getting better and better as it went on. Like mm-hmm. its earlier seasons are great, I love them, but the Mad Men is a show that improved with every year, I think, or just about. And I totally get having Breaking Bad win because those are awesome as well.
Yeah.
Homeland's a show I never really got into. I watched about 2/3 of the first season and was not super into it.
Yeah. I had the same reaction. I watched, you know, first half or so of the season and anytime we had to deal with, his family, I was just like, this is dumb.
This is the worst possible thing.
This is the worst. This is supposed to be a spy show. I don't care.
Yeah, otherwise, I mean, basically with the Emmys, what you get is a lot of the times you just get the same shows nominated.
I was
going to
say, this is kind of like the most rote, like, Emmy nomination category.
Yeah. I mean, with the exception of Better Call Saul and Orange is the New Black, all of these shows have been nominated before. All of these shows were nominated last year, I'm pretty sure.
Probably.
Orange is the New Black last year. This is nominating for Orange is the New Black's 2nd season because the 3rd season just came out.
Right.
So it just missed the eligibility thing. Mm-hmm. But its 1st season was nominated in the comedy category. And now it's in drama. Which is very,
that's
you know, the Emmys have a weird thing where the Academy doesn't decide whether something is a comedy or a drama. The creators of the show submit their own nominations into the categories.
Right.
And so a lot of times what happens is they will submit, or not even the creators of the show, the network often does it instead. Mm-hmm. They will submit it into the category that they think they have the best chance of winning.
Right.
As opposed to the category that actually represents
what
show
they are.
Is. So, for example, last year, the Emmys have a category called Best Miniseries or Movie.
Mm-hmm.
And in that category, you had shows like Fargo and American Horror Story, which I would not consider miniseries.
I would consider Fargo season 1 before we knew there was a season 2. That could have been a miniseries.
Well, they had already announced a season 2 at the time. I mean, yeah.
Had they? Okay, fair enough.
I mean, I guess it could have been, but it's like a mini. Fargo is an anthology series,
right?
So it's an ongoing show that just has a different cast and stories every season. And American Horror Story is the same thing.
Same thing.
But the thing is, True Detective was nominated as a drama that same year, where if it was going by the same criteria as Fargo,
it would be in the miniseries.
Exactly. And Fargo ended up winning the miniseries because True Detective went into drama and lost.
Drama.
Because it was Breaking Bad's last season.
Right. They messed up.
If True Detective had gone into miniseries, it would have won easily.
It like, definitely would have won,
hands
yeah.
down. And not even because I think True Detective is a better show, but just because that was like the critical consensus at the time was that True Detective was so widely respected. Like,
yeah.
And now it's not. So how times have changed.
Yeah.
You know, spoiler for your discussion.
For my discussions, I guess.
I mean, I don't know how you're feeling about True Detective so far, but we'll talk about that in a bit.
Yeah, we'll have to see.
And
stay tuned.
The best comedy category. The nominations are Louie, Modern Family, Parks and Recreation, Silicon Valley, Transparent, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, and Veep. So first of all, I would like to commend the Emmys on not nominating The Big Bang Theory again.
Thank God. That show needs to die.
Yeah, because that's usually nominated. But Modern Family is in this.
Yeah.
And Modern Family has won the Emmy for the last 5 years.
So chalk it up to Modern Family then.
Yeah, I can't even fathom why Modern Family is still winning that award. Like it's like
I don't know.
It was never, in my opinion, the best comedy on TV.
Yeah,
and yet it's won 5 years in a row, and that's every year that it's been on the air. And so I'm, you know, perplexed at its very existence of these shows.
Mm-hmm.
Parks and Rec just had its final season, so I could see that maybe pulling out.
Yeah.
Trying to get it. Louie, I don't think is that. Louie's never won Best Comedy, and I would love to see Louie get it. Louie has won Emmys in the past for, like, Best Writing and Best Actor.
Right. But not specifically for a genre.
Not for Best Comedy, yeah.
Right.
But of all these shows, I'd love to see Silicon Valley take it.
You know, yeah, that would be great.
Silicon Valley is amazing. Veep is amazing. Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, I'm super happy to see here.
Yeah, I'm excited that the Emmys, I mean, are embracing the Netflix shows. Like, I know there's still TV shows in some kind of basic sense.
They really they actually really are embracing the digital streaming services.
Yeah, Transparent also, right?
Yeah, which is an Amazon Prime show, which I've never watched because I don't have Amazon Prime. but, you know, that's the way it goes, I guess. But yeah. I've heard it's great. I actually could see them giving it to Transparent.
That would be cool, too.
Yeah, like, that's a really interesting-sounding show. I'd really like to... Would like to see it if I get Amazon Prime at some point.
One day.
Or maybe if it pops up on Netflix, who knows?
Who knows? I don't think that's how that works.
No, it's not going to happen. And that Transparent also won the Golden Globe for Best Comedy
right.
TV Show.
Yeah, I do remember that.
So, you never know. Other surprises, some cool little tidbits about the Emmys. Will Forte was nominated for Best Actor for Last Man on Earth.
So I know who you're voting for.
I do love Will Forte, and I love Last Man on Earth, so I'm really excited about that. Last Man on Earth is actually nominated for a few things. It was nominated for Best Writing for its pilot episode and Best Directing for its pilot episode.
Wow.
The pilot was directed by Phil Lord and Chris Miller.
Of course.
So, you know, I personally, out of those nominations, I think it should be a shoo-in to win, based on my personal
What a surprise.
Opinions, of my personal opinions. Also, Bob Odenkirk was nominated for Best Actor for Better Call Saul. Mm-hmm. Jonathan Banks was also nominated for Better Call Saul. As
really,
well.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, yes, and he was nominated a couple like once or twice for Breaking Bad as well, Jonathan Banks. But
okay,
yes, but he's great. He's great on Better Call Saul as well. Bob Odenkirk, and I think Odenkirk has shown like such great dramatic flair in Better Call Saul that we haven't really gotten to see from him that much. We saw a little bit of that on Breaking Bad, but he flips between comedy and drama so well in Better Call Saul. I think it would just be a really cool surprise if he ended up winning. I don't think he will.
I don't think so, but that would be amazing.
Yeah. And Amy Schumer is nominated for Best Actress in a Comedy for Inside Amy Schumer, which I think is great, because she's great. She's really funny. I'm really excited for Trainwreck. I haven't gotten a chance to see that yet.
Yeah, me neither.
And Inside Amy Schumer is a show that I haven't watched extensively, but I've seen, like, a lot of the sketches here and there.
Mm-hmm.
And she's always really good. And I think it's great that they're recognizing a sketch comedy show, which they don't tend to do that often.
Yeah, that's true. And she's having this, like, moment. And I think it's awesome.
Yeah, like it's a sort of like a cultural phenomenon of Amy Schumer.
Yeah,
you know, now that Trainwreck just came out, she just had that GQ cover shoot where she did the Star Wars poses. which I guess Lucasfilm was really upset about.
I saw that they got all butthurt about it.
Which, you know, grow up, Lucasfilm.
Get over it.
Yeah, come on. Like, you don't get to make a ubiquitous 40-year sci-fi franchise without having people, like, parody it. Like, come on.
Yeah.
So I think it's really cool that she's nominated for this. And also, Jon Hamm. This is his last chance to win Best Actor in a Drama from Mad Men.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, an interesting tidbit about Mad Men. It probably has the best cast on TV. And it has never won a single acting award at the Emmys.
Really?
Yeah. That's absolutely true. And I think it's super weird.
That's bizarre.
Yeah. Like, you would just have assumed that would happen at some
point. At least once.
Yeah. And Jon Hamm has never won for Don Draper, and I think this is his last chance to do it. But he's also nominated for an Emmy this year for Guest Actor in a Comedy Series for Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
Really?
Yeah. And so I think it would be really funny if he won that instead.
Oh, my God.
And didn't win Best Actor for Mad Men.
That's the best. I hope that happens.
So those are just a few thoughts I had about the Emmy nominations. And I guess, Mike, we can move on into our discussions.
Yeah, sure.
All right. So, Mike, you wanted to discuss a little TV show.
Yeah, you might have heard of it.
Yeah, sort of a cultural phenomenon back in 2014.
way back when we were but children.
Yeah.
So True Detective Season 2 has begun and is about halfway over.
Yes, so at the time of this, 5 episodes have aired. I've seen the first 5. I've seen all 5. You've only seen the first 4.
Yeah, I haven't watched the latest episode yet.
Okay. But so, give me, now that you're halfway through season 2 of True Detective, like, what's your overall take on the show so far?
I like it. Not as much as season 1, which I think will be hard to top because, like, just, it's impossible. Season 1 was so out of nowhere as far I remember it. Like, I was like, yeah, whatever, I don't really, like, I'm not that interested. And then people were talking about it, and, like, episode 4 happened with that 10-minute-long take or whatever that was.
Right, yeah.
And everyone was like, you have to, so I watched it and was like, holy crap, this is the best thing ever, and got so wrapped up in the mystery that it's one of my favorite things that's happened on TV. I think it's impossible for that to happen for True Detective again.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the element of surprise, I think, was part of what made True Detective Season 1 so good.
Yeah, exactly.
I think Season 2 has been, I don't want to say bad, because I think there are...
It has a lot of moments that are awesome.
I think there are some really cool moments. At the beginning of episode 3 has one of the weirdest sequences I've seen so far in this TV year.
Yeah.
And it's very, like, Twin Peaks-esque. Like, it's very, like...
outside of David Lynch, that was, like, amazing.
That's the reason I watch the show, is for stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think that's been a complaint, too, a lot of people have had. At least, or for me, at least, too. This season is a little too on the nose with some of its, like, symbolism stuff. Like, season 1 had some really deep, like... stuff that you had to, like, look and think about. And in this one, like, in episode 4, episode 3, I know it's a little spoilery or whatever, I guess, but, like, oh, Vince Vaughn is impotent or whatever, his character. And then, like, episode 4 begins, and, like, his avocado trees can't bear fruit, and they're dying. And it's like, come on, like, I get it, Nick Pizzolatto, like. It's still cool, though.
Yeah.
I like it a lot.
The thing is, season 1 had so many things going for it that season 2 doesn't. Just for example, Cary Fukunaga directed every episode of season 1.
Right.
And Fukunaga's an amazing director, and his visual style, I think, elevated season 1 so much more than season 2 has. Season 2 is not done by Cary Fukunaga, and it's not done by, like, one unified director the entire time.
Several, there's different directors.
Different directors every episode. The first 2 episodes were directed by Justin Lin,
right?
Who directed the Fast and Furious movies.
Yeah.
But, like, they've been switching directors ever since. And, I don't know, I feel like the unified vision that Cary Fukunaga had for the show is part of what made season 1 so good. And also, McConaughey's performance and Woody Harrelson's performance was so good. McConaughey especially, I thought, was incredible in that show.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like... there's a lot of really good actors on the show. I think Colin Farrell's doing really good work.
Yeah.
I think Rachel McAdams is great.
She's killing it. They're my two favorite on the show so far.
And I think Taylor Kitsch is kind of boring, personally. Yeah. And Vince Vaughn, I was really excited for to be on True Detective Season 2 because I was really excited to see what he would do with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like he's just been kind of generic gangster.
I think he is doing a really good job with really shitty writing because not one single human talks the way he talks on this show.
Yes, and that's, I think, part of the problem. Every character on the show in Season 2 mm-hmm. talks like Matthew McConaughey talked in Season 1.
Especially Frank or Vince Vaughn, that character.
Especially Vince Vaughn. But like part of what made McConaughey's character so unique and so cool is that he was the only character in Season 1 who talked like that.
Right, absolutely.
You know? And now you have every character talking like that, and it just feels like this obtuse, like, you know, obtrusive thing where you can't, like, get inside the characters' heads. You can't really understand. It's really tough to understand what's going on in the show, I think.
And like, I think that was something that Season 1 nailed so well, too. Like, at its heart, it's, like, procedural cop drama. Like, its basic structure.
But I think part of what, like, Season 1 wasn't really interested in the mystery at all, I thought. Like, it was more focused on McConaughey and Harrelson, like, their inner lives.
Right.
And I thought that was a lot more interesting. And this Season 2 has, like, doubled down on the mystery, I think.
Oh, I feel the other way, actually.
Really?
I feel Season 1 was so strong because, I mean, yeah, it's focused on, you know, McConaughey and Harrelson. But the mystery, the, like, actual crime and case that they're solving is really interesting and hard. Like, it's something that's engaging. And I feel like in Season 2, we have four plot lines and also a mystery that's like, yeah, well, whatever, there's this thing happening. So, I don't know, maybe it's just a personal preference.
I could definitely see that. I mean, I think the mystery was more engaging in the first season.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm trying to say, yeah. Like, I don't really care about who this dead guy is.
Part of what made, I think, the first season really cool was its flashback structure, where, you know, most of the season was McConaughey and Harrelson in different rooms being, like, interrogated by these
just being interviewed,
officers. Yeah. And then, you know, you'd see, like, what happened in flashbacks and stuff. You don't have that in this one.
Yeah, I love that. In episode, I think it's 3, we get that, like, nameless henchman gets killed, and it's, like, a huge motivating factor for Frank. Yet we don't know, we've never seen him before. Like,
yeah.
It's, like, hilarious. There's just a lot of weird, misplaced, like, motivation, I guess. I don't know. But it's still, I'm still into it, because there is a lot, there, like, it, as much as the symbolism and, like, weird stuff is on the nose a lot, there is a lot of really cool, like, hidden thing. I don't know if hidden's the right word, but, like, smaller things.
Right.
Like, there was just one scene when Annie, Rachel McAdams' character, and they're going to visit her, like, estranged father, and they're playing in the background the Blind Faith song, Can't Find My Way Home. And it's like, oh, yeah, like, awesome shit like that. Like, that's what I love about this show. It has a lot of...
A lot of that, yeah.
Film nerdy shit going on.
And, I mean, the show can still pull off some genuinely thrilling sequences. I thought the shootout at the end of episode 4 was great.
That was awesome.
I had no idea why it happened or what it meant for the characters, but, like...
But it was cool.
It was thrilling. Like, it was, like, viscerally thrilling to watch. And it was long. It was, like, a 10-minute sequence.
Yeah.
So I like that. And I, it's sort of it's spoilery to say, but the ending of episode 2, where Colin Farrell, like, infiltrates a house.
Yeah.
That was great. It left on a great cliffhanger. And a cliffhanger that was very hilariously resolved at the beginning of episode 3.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really funny. I thought that was, like, a nice touch. I mean, I feel like the show could use some more humor.
Just, like, a tiny bit.
Like, think of season 1 was pretty funny. Like, there was...
Yeah, Woody Harrelson as the foil to Matthew McConaughey is, like, just macabre, like, insanity.
There was some banter back and forth there that was really funny and entertaining. I still use... Woody Harrelson has a line in that show that I still use every once in a while, which is, you're the Michael Jordan of being a son of a bitch.
I think my favorite line from that is, I just want you to stop saying odd shit.
Yeah.
Like that. But there was stuff like that, and season 2 kind of lacks that a little bit.
You don't have anybody wanting them to stop saying odd shit, because everybody's saying odd shit. So it's...
that's a perfect way to put it, yeah. You're right.
You know, I think Matt Zeller-Seitz, who's a really great critic on RogerEbert.com, was talking about True Detective, and he was saying, like, you have Kirk and you have Spock. You don't have four Spocks.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good way to put it. So, I mean, maybe, I don't know, maybe it was a fluke for Nick Pizzolatto to nail season one, the dialogue, and then writing of season one.
Well, the thing is, I don't feel like the writing has changed all that much. I just feel like the actual structure of the show, the actors and the director, like, that all of that was made season one so great, and I feel like season two is lacking a lot of those elements. But it still has a lot of interesting stuff about it. I'm going to watch it till the end.
Yeah, I'm committed, definitely. So hopefully, I mean, if there is a season three, I don't know. We'll see. I guess I'm sure there will be because HBO. But
I feel like
I hope they go back to one director for the whole season because that really is a strong point.
My dream True Detective is let's say it runs for like five seasons. Okay,
goes on forever.
Okay, and then it runs for six seasons. The first five seasons are like different casts, different mysteries, different like things going on.
Yeah,
and season six is the True Detective Avengers, where you. Where you have like McConaughey and Harrelson like teaming up for one last job, but they have to team up with like Colin Farrell and Rachel McAdams.
Uh-huh. Oh my god, that would be amazing.
I would be into it.
What if that's just the plan of every show from now on?
Just have enough different things to happen so that you can
just shared universe for everything.
Yep.
I'm in.
Yeah. And speaking of shared universe, let's talk about Ant-Man. No.
Yeah, let's go.
I have my thing to talk about also.
Oh, yes.
So that was True Detective, and I wanted to briefly discuss another show that I've been watching that I just finished up, actually. It's called Garfunkel and Oates. And Garfunkel and Oates, if you're not familiar, is a comedy band featuring Kate Micucci and Ricky Lindholm. I've been a fan of the band for a really long time, and they came out with a TV show last year that aired on IFC. It aired 8 episodes. And the show was canceled shortly after it aired. So it was only one season, 8 episodes. But they are all on Netflix.
Yes, they are.
And they are all available to watch. And I wanted to watch it when it aired. But I did not have IFC at the time, so I couldn't.
There you go.
So I wanted to support, but I was not able to. But now that it's on Netflix, I was able to. And it's a pretty funny show. You know, it's a lot of... a pretty funny show. It's very similar to, like, Flight of the Conchords, I think, a little bit. Where... you know, you'll just have these situations, and they'll have, like, songs interspersed throughout the show.
Mm-hmm.
I would have liked to see more original songs in the show. A lot of the time, they use, like, songs they've already done and, like, and like kind of write a show around them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, and it works, but, you know, I think I would have preferred them to do, like, newer stuff as opposed... Like, I've heard, like, Weed Card and Pregnant Women Are Smug, like, many times before. But, yeah... Still a funny show, and there's a lot of funny guest stars, like Kumail Nanjiani is on this show. I want to say Stephen Merchant was on, I think, at some point. I might be totally off on that, but Busy Phillips from Freaks and Geeks of Cougar Town has a supporting role in this show. And yeah, it's a lot of fun. I think Kate Micucci and Ricky Lindholm are a good duo. So if you're a fan of the band Garfunkel and Oates, you should check the show out. And if you're not a fan of the band, you should check out the band, because they're pretty funny.
Now, have you watched their new show, Another Period?
Central? I have not. Oh, that's a. It's not. That's Ricky Lindholm. I don't think Kate McCutcheon.
Oh, it's just Ricky Lindholm. Oh, I didn't even know that.
Yes, but I have seen things about that. I've heard it's pretty good.
Yeah, I haven't checked it out yet. I've heard it's good though.
Yeah. But anyway, so that is Garfunkel and Oates. Basically, the polar opposite of True Detective.
Yeah. Didn't even realize that. Yeah.
And yeah, so I think we can now move on. Are you ready, Mike?
I'm ready.
All right. So.
What a rickety segue.
Yeah. I got a really good idea for a dumb joke, but I have to figure out how to use it. So let's just say, let's move on to our feature review of Ant-Man.
Imagine a soldier. The size of an insect. The ultimate secret weapon.
If you give godlike powers to everyone, it's going to be chaos.
So how do we stop him?
By knowing I. Scott. I've been watching you for a while. You're different. And I believe everyone deserves a shot at redemption. Do you?
Absolutely. My days of breaking into places and stealing stuff are over. What do you want me to do?
I want you to break into a place and steal some stuff.
Makes sense.
Are you ready to become a hero?
Now, the suit has power. You have to learn how to control it. And these are your greatest allies.
You're kind of cute. Whoa.
When you're small, you have superhuman strength. You like a bullet. So you need to know how to punch.
You want to show me how to punch? Show me how to punch.
That's how you punch.
You tried to hide your suit from me. Now, it's gonna blow up in your face and destroy everyone you care about.
Scott, get out of here!
Did you think you could stop the future? You're just a thief!
No.
I'm Ant-Man. I know. Wasn't my idea.
What is this? A movie for ants?
God damn it. perfect.
That was from the trailer for Ant-Man, the newest film from director Peyton Reed. It's written by Edgar Wright, Joe Cornish, Adam McKay, and Paul Rudd. It stars Paul Rudd, Evangeline Lilly, Michael Douglas, Corey Stoll, Bobby Cannavale, Michael Pena, Tip T.I. Harris, Wood Harris, Judy Greer, and David Desmalchin. And the IMDb plot summary of Ant-Man: armed with a supersuit with the astonishing ability to shrink in scale but increase in strength, cat burglar Scott Lang must embrace his inner hero and help his mentor, Dr. Hank Pym, plan and pull off a heist that will save the world. Before we begin our review of Ant-Man, I think we should talk a little bit about the movie's production.
Okay.
Because Edgar Wright, who is one of my favorite directors, director of films like Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, Scott Pilgrim vs. the World and The World's End, was developing this movie for 8 years. Since 2006, before the Marvel Cinematic Universe was even a thing.
Right.
This movie was announced in 2006 alongside Iron Man and The Incredible Hulk.
Was it really?
Yes.
Holy crap, I don't remember that.
Yeah. I mean, that was 8 years ago, so...
True.
It was 8 years ago, so you're forgiven in not remembering that.
Okay, fair enough. Thanks.
And, you know, Edgar Wright was working on this movie for a really long time. He was writing this with his pal Joe Cornish, who was the writer and director of Attack the Block. And I was really excited to see Edgar Wright's version of Ant-Man, because I love Edgar Wright. He's one of the most dynamic and interesting directors working today.
Yeah.
And the movie was even... Like, Ant-Man was supposed to happen a long time ago, this movie. And it was even postponed so that Edgar Wright could work on The World's End.
Wow.
Yeah. And so Edgar Wright was going to be directing this movie. And weeks before filming of this movie started, like last year, Edgar Wright said to drop out. Over creative differences, and the studio was left to scramble to find a new director.
Yeah.
And a lot of directors were looked at, like David Wayne and Adam McKay. Adam McKay ended up co-writing the movie with Paul Rudd.
Mm-hmm.
And it ended up going to Peyton Reed, director of films like Down With Love, Bring It On, and Yes Man. We'll likely never know how different or how similar Edgar Wright's approach to the film was from the final product, at least not for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And, you know, it took me a while to come around to the idea of Ant-Man again, because... I was really excited to see Edgar Wright's version, and him leaving Marvel was like me thinking, like, well, Marvel is bad for filmmakers, you know.
They must suck, yeah.
This whole thing, like, it really tore me up, because I love Marvel, but I love Edgar Wright. But the thing is, I love Edgar Wright more. Like,
okay.
Like, Marvel makes a lot of really good movies, like a lot of really fun movies, I think. But I think Edgar Wright's movies are, like, on another level, you know?
Yeah.
And so I was pretty disappointed about what Ant-Man could be. For a while, because I wasn't really sure how it was going to turn out. But over time, you know, I started seeing trailers for Ant-Man. I started, like, hearing things about it. And it looked pretty good. You know, I was... and I kind of came back around to Ant-Man. And so I wanted to discuss that briefly, because I want to say that it's not fair to judge the movie based on what something else might have done with the property.
Right.
You know, instead, let's look at what we're given. And though its troubled production can be used as context for the movie, like saying... explain why something went wrong in the movie because this happened during production.
Yeah.
You know, we shouldn't try to compare this film to one that doesn't exist.
Right. I agree.
So, with that all said, and keeping in mind that I love Edgar Wright, and I'm trying not to have, like, a bias against this movie, I mean, it's a pretty fun movie. So...
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
You know, I enjoyed the movie. And so I think I like that we've reached a point where we can make a movie based on a superhero whose only power is to shrink and talk to ants. And everyone's like, Marvel's making it? Okay, cool.
Done. I'm in.
Yeah, I'm in. Like, that's totally cool. So, Mike, I guess I'll talk to you first. What your general reaction of Ant-Man coming out of the movie?
I had a lot of fun watching a guy shrink. That was, like, it was, yeah, like, it bordered, you that whole setup that Edgar Wright's gone, but I feel like this, his, like, hand fingerprints or whatever are all over this movie.
Okay, yeah, I think there is some Edgar Wright DNA still in the film, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. It is, at its core, an action comedy. I mean, as are most Marvel movies, you know. Joss Whedon, action comedy.
Sure.
But this one has a much more of an that Edgar Wright feel. I don't know how to describe it, but without going into specific scenes and stuff. But I'm on board. Somehow, Marvel has this amazing ability for me to watch one of their movies and then walk out of the theater and immediately want to go on Wikipedia and learn everything about the Marvel Universe that I possibly can and just be obsessed with this and think out what is going to happen in every movie because they link shit and it's amazing and the hype is very real. So
so you learn everything about Marvel every 6 months.
Is that every 6 months, basically. I just refresh. I troll Wikipedia for a long time afterwards. So that's what I'll be doing the rest of today.
Fair enough. Yeah, I mean, I think, it's amazing to me that Marvel is able to put out a pretty good Ant-Man movie. And DC is still struggling to make Batman and Superman work. Like, these are,
right.
You know, these are heroes that are huge. Like, everybody loves Batman and Superman, but, like, nobody's super enthusiastic. I mean, there are people enthusiastic about the new Batman for Superman movie, but nobody, Man of Steel was very divisive. Superman Returns was pretty divisive. The Dark Knight Rises was pretty divisive. DC's having a difficult time trying to get everybody on board for Batman and Superman. And here comes Marvel. It's bringing out, like, a third-tier hero.
Right.
Who is never... Ant-Man has never even been popular enough to, like, support his own comic.
Yet.
Yes. Well, actually, yes. He has a new comic now. Well, because he has a new movie out. And side note, that comic is great. Yeah,
that's awesome. That's great to hear. That's cool.
Yeah, the first 5 issues of that comic are out. That's just finished its run. So the first 5 issues came out, and now they're doing Secret Wars. And so once Secret Wars is done, they're like continuing the Ant-Man thing, but it's going to be like renumbered to number one. But those first 5 issues by Nick Spencer writing it, terrific. Like, they're super funny, and they capture the tone of this movie actually pretty well.
That's awesome.
And they're very much about Scott Lang trying to reconnect with his daughter and all that kind of thing. In that comic, actually, his daughter is a teenager. Whereas here, she's like 8 years old.
Yeah, she's a toddler.
But in any case, Ant-Man is a very fun movie. I do think the movie takes some time to find its footing. I think the first half is filled with relatively generic family dynamics.
Yeah.
Ex-husband wants to do right by his kid. Stepdad doesn't want the ex-husband in the picture. That whole thing.
Yeah.
It's more down-to-earth and human than we come to expect from Marvel.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
It's a smaller story, but I don't think it does anything particularly new with that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the movie's sense of humor is a little all over the place, which is sort of a given, considering it has 4 really talented comedic writers working on it.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't always land for me, especially in the beginning, but I think it meshes well together, especially by the halfway point. The second half is where it picks up, I think. It ramps up the action, starts delivering humor like every couple every line, and it gets really, really creative from a visual standpoint.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yes.
I think that trust that the audience has, I think, with Marvel, like you were saying, DC's having trouble getting on board. And I think it's because Marvel has had such a track run, you know, and they have 12 movies now that, you know, people are confident that they will do justice and will be awesome.
Yeah.
But with 12 movies, you know, we're in this franchise, whatever you want, a universe, I don't know what other word to use for this. we kind of have a formula now, and I feel like...
Yeah, it's absolutely a formula.
Yeah, and that's what's happening. That kind of shines through in the first half of Ant-Man. Like, that's what I think that's where that's coming from.
Yeah, I mean, Ant-Man, I think, bears the most similarity to the original Iron Man in terms of how it's, like, superhero origins kind of come about. He gets a super suit.
Right, yeah.
But, true. You know, I think in terms of, like, the structure of the story, like, it feels very similar to the original Iron Man. It's actually Ant-Man is the first, like, solo superhero origin story that Marvel has done since Captain America 1.
Yeah.
Which is actually kind of nuts. Like,
that's cool.
I didn't realize that until recently.
It took them until Iron Man 12.
At its best, I think, this movie does have some Edgar Wright DNA, as we mentioned. I think in particular some of the editing sequences.
Yes.
So there's like montages that occur as Michael Peña's character, Louise, like recounts stories.
That's exactly what I was thinking of.
Yeah, and the editing just goes like, like it's back and forth. You hear the whoosh sound that occurs during Edgar Wright's movies.
It reminded me of the montages from Shaun of the Dead when he's like, "We're gonna go pick up Mom. We're gonna kill Philip. We're gonna go to the Winchester and have a like that whole that stuff." Very very reminiscent of that.
Yes, but I think at its best, instead of Edgar Wright, this movie actually reminded me more of the works of like Robert Zemeckis and Joe Dante, like back in the '80s when they were just doing like goofy like unabashed fun. That's not afraid to get like weird and zany. Mm-hmm. Like at this best, this movie reminded me of like Who Framed Roger Rabbit and Innerspace, the Joe Dante movie, which I talked about on a podcast recently. Yeah, Innerspace is obviously a shrinking movie as well. Mm-hmm. I think we discussed the creative visuals. I think it is the most visually dynamic of any Marvel movie.
Yeah,
and that's almost by necessity because the film has to have a lot of fun bringing us down to Scott's perspective to turn everyday objects into potentially a threat.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I like to. I just read a slash film thing about Peyton Reed when he. I don't remember exactly what it was, but they applauded the fact that it embraced the Ant-Man. Like there's the line in the trailer when Scott Lang asks, "Is it too late to change the name?"
Yeah,
but they cut that from the movie, and Peyton Reed said that you know the film itself needs to embrace and own the weirdness of Ant-Man, like, and he's kind of lame, but it needs to not be self-deprecating in order for the audience to actually appreciate it. And I think that's true. They kind of make a little few winks a little bit, but it's not the whole movie isn't a joke that Ant-Man is like lame.
And yeah. That's
makes
true.
It awesome.
Yeah. I think there actually is that in the trailers a lot. They have a few lines in the trailers where there's another line where it's like, "I'm the Ant-Man. I know. It wasn't my idea."
Right, exactly. That thing.
And there is there's very little of that in the actual movie. They do actually kind of like embrace the fact like, okay, this is super silly. This is like sort of a ridiculous hero, but like, you know, we're going to make this work. And that's part of what I think Marvel does really well is like, all right, we have this stuff on the page. It works on the page. It can probably work on the screen if we just like believe it'll work.
Right. Exactly. You
know?
Yeah.
Which is why we have creations like The Vision in Age of Ultron.
Right.
You know, that's if that movie was made 10 years ago, The Vision would not look like that, like at all. You know, it's like in Fantastic Four: Rise of the Silver Surfer, Galactus was a giant cloud. You know, like that's
right.
You know, we've come a long way from that. We've come a long. We've come into a time where we can accept just super ridiculous stuff in these comic book movies.
Weird comic book things that will take for real. Like, that's fine.
Yeah, and it totally works because that's the world that Marvel has established now.
Yeah. You know,
they can do crazy stuff and everybody's on board. Mm-hmm. And I love that about it. Like, I think it's great. I think the cast of this movie is awesome. Paul Rudd is really solid in the movie. I mean, I love Paul Rudd, like, to death.
In general.
He's great. And... You know, he's one of my favorite comedic actors, and I think he brings enough of his goofy personality here, while still shining as, like, an accidental hero in the movie. Michael Douglas is a great Hank Pym, and I think his relationship with Hope was kind of a weak point, which we'll talk about in a minute. His relationship with Scott provides some of the film's best moments, I think. Mm-hmm. And Corey Stahl, like, throws his all into, like, a scenery-chewing villain. He's a blast to watch, I think. Like, he is... Really,
he does an awesome job.
Yeah, there's a scene at the beginning where he's like talking to his investors, and Hank Pym's there, And he's, like, talking about, like, the Ant-Man suit, and he's, like, going off, and he's like, oh, you know, the Ant-Man suit. It's like, you know, yeah. What? Like, these are fairy tales. Tales to astonish. Yeah. Which was a pretty good Easter egg. If you're familiar with Ant-Man, the very first comic that he ever appeared in was Tales to Astonish.
How about that?
Yeah, little throw in there.
That's cool.
But I think his character, Darren Cross, kind of comes across as a knockoff of Obadiah Stane from the first Iron Man movie.
Yeah.
To the point where he builds his own suit and fights Ant-Man.
I mean, it's generic, like, guy owns an arms company, doesn't care about stuff, like, just wants to make money.
Yeah.
Like, there's that, like, propaganda film they show, like, when he introduces the yellow jacket
right.
thing, and it's, like, spreading peace over the globe, and it's just, like, little yellow jackets, like, murdering people. And it's, like, I don't...
I hope that's how that works.
Yeah, I was like, is this a weird, like, world where, like, that just is okay? Like, we just accept propaganda for what it is? Like, I don't know, it was very weird. It reminded me, I'm reading Scud the Disposable Assassin, the comic by Dan right. Harmon, or Rob Schraub, co-written by Dan Harmon a few times. And that kind of world exists, where we just have, like, robot assassins in vending machines. And that propaganda in the... Ant-Man reminded me of Scud. It's like, oh, that's cool. Okay, fine.
Yes. And so I also want to talk about Hope Van Dyne, which is Evangeline Lilly's character. And here's the thing. I think she's a solid character. I think Evangeline Lilly's good in the movie.
Yeah.
But I think she is symbolic of Marvel's difficulties with female characters.
Absolutely.
You know, I think aside from Black Widow and Scarlet Witch, I think it's rare for a woman to take center stage in one of Marvel's superhero movies. Really, really superhero movies in general. Like, let's not say it's just Marvel.
Yeah.
But Marvel has had a particular problem with it. And they tried to, like, bring it down a little bit. They announced a Captain Marvel movie. But that's not coming for another 3 years.
Right.
We don't even have somebody attached to that yet or anything like that.
Anything, yeah.
And so, I think her character... here's the thing. Her character is much more clearly qualified and smarter than Scott.
Yes.
And yet she still gets to do virtually nothing during this film.
Yep.
And there's a scene towards the end of the movie that I do want to talk about that we'll talk about in spoilers. But yeah. I think it sort of winks at the fact that she doesn't get much to do in this film, but she will get stuff to do in later movies.
Right.
But I would have rather seen her do stuff in this movie.
Yeah, or like, at least acknowledge, like, the whole thing is, you know, he won't let her do this because it's his daughter and doesn't want to lose her.
Right.
But, like, they could have worked at that more. I don't know exactly. They kind of just, like, let that excuse. They're like, yeah, no, that's fine.
I feel like that's such a weak excuse, though.
Like, yeah, that's what I mean. They could have.
Yeah.
He could have given that excuse, and it would have been okay if she had called it, like, acknowledged that that's bullshit. If they had called attention to that instead of like her just being like yeah, that's fine.
I feel like she did at some point during the movie, no? Like, she kept, like, saying, like, no, I want to do this. Like, that's stupid. Like.
Yeah, but then Scott Lang in the car is like, oh, he's doing it. You know, he wants to save you. I'm expendable or whatever he says.
Right.
And she's like, oh, yeah, you're right. Okay, that's fine. And it's like, well, that's weird. How could, like, I don't know. But it's not problematic to the point where it diminishes the movie. It's just something that it could have done better.
Yeah, I mean, I think the movie itself is still really solid and a lot of fun. But I think its handling of Hope, because they set her up as such a strong character.
Yeah, she's a badass.
Yeah, and she gets nothing to do. Like, she's literally never there whenever anything's going down. So I think we're going to move into spoilers in very shortly. I do think it's nice to have a Marvel movie that has, like, smaller stakes, you know, especially after Age of Ultron, which had, like, a giant city floating in the sky and, like, robots going to destroy the entire Earth.
Right.
You know, and I still think I prefer Ultron in all of its ambitious craziness. But I think Ant-Man provides, like, a fun diversion between two super large-scale Marvel releases, which are Age of Ultron and Civil War.
Yeah. I mean, at its core, also, this is a heist movie.
Yeah.
Which is awesome.
Yeah, it's a fun little thing there. Yeah, there's a lot of fun, like, heist-esque sequences. A lot of cool stuff there. Marvel's been trying to, like, experiment doing, like, different kinds of genres within their superhero movies.
Yeah.
Which is part of what I think makes Marvel's movies successful, because they're not just doing superhero movies. They're making Ant-Man a heist movie. They're making Winter Soldier, like a conspiracy thriller. They made a World War II propaganda movie with the first Captain America.
Right.
You know, so I think they're trying to do interesting stuff. Guardians of the Galaxy was a big, crazy space adventure.
Space opera, yeah.
Yeah.
What did you think of the supporting cast of T.I. and Michael Pena and that other guy who I've seen, but I don't remember his name?
David S. Malchin. Actually, he is a... I had to look him up because I recognized him. I didn't know from where.
I know he's from Dark Knight.
Yeah, that's what it was. He's the guy that the Joker kidnaps in the Dark Knight. Or not the Joker kidnaps, but he's like...
that Two-Face kidnaps.
Yeah, the Two-Face kidnaps that he tries to get information about the Joker from. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he was that guy. So
yeah, that dude. What did you think of them?
They were fun. I think Michael Pena's great in this movie.
Oh my God. He was hilarious.
Yeah, he's really funny. yeah, he had some great lines, especially at the beginning where he was like, my family was... like, oh, how you doing? Like, oh, I'm good. My mom died.
My wife left me.
My stepdad was supportive. Yeah.
But I got the band.
Yeah. Yeah, and he has, and his sequences where he's describing the jobs that he's, like, about to do are mm-hmm. really funny.
Yeah, those are great.
The montages where they just have, like, his voice dubbed over, like, people talking.
Yeah.
Really great.
I did like, too, the T.I. and David whatever. Like, they kind of had the Ocean's 11 type bit while they're like the outside, the support people outside the heist.
Yeah.
And just everything is going wrong for them.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really funny. Like, the steal in the cop car and, like, all that stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know. So that was cool. I liked that, you know, the genre of the heist movie, that type of thing was in there.
Yes.
And they did a really good job.
Yeah. Also, I wanted to just mention, Judy Greer is in this movie.
She is.
For some reason.
Yeah.
Judy Greer, this really has nothing to do with Ant-Man, but Judy Greer has been in 4 movies this summer.
Mm-hmm.
Jurassic World, Tomorrowland, Entourage, and now Ant-Man. And she is completely wasted in all of them. Like,
all of them.
Maybe not in Entourage, I didn't see Entourage, but in Jurassic World, Tomorrowland, this movie, she's playing somebody's mom.
She's the same character.
Yeah, she's just, like, she's there to be the mom. Like, she's not doing anything, like, interesting. Which sucks, because Judy Greer is amazing.
She's, I think, great.
She's so good. She, you know, she's on Archer, she's on Arrested Development. And she's been in movies before and has had good roles. And, you know, even, like, last year, she was in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, where she played a silent motion-capture ape. Like, that was...
What?
Yeah, and it was... yeah, she was Caesar's wife in that movie.
What? Why is that Judy Greer? What the fuck? That's awesome.
Like, this is Judy Greer, one of our, like, greatest national treasures. And she's being completely wasted in these movies. And I think it's disappointing, because I think she's so good and can do so much more than these movies are requiring her. She's literally in Tomorrowland for, like, 10 seconds. Like,
yeah, I think she has, like, maybe a full minute of screen time in Ant-Man? Like, she's barely in this.
She, like, shows up to get, like, to scold Scott at the beginning, and then to be worried about the daughter at the end.
To be scared at the end. That's about it.
Anyway, I just wanted to bring that up, because I love Judy Greer, and it's disappointing to me that's, you know, she's being totally used in these movies.
Yeah.
In any case, let's move on to spoilers for Ant-Man.
I'm Ants-In My Eyes Johnson, here at Ants-In My Eyes Johnson's Electronics. I mean, there's so many ants in my eyes, and there's so many TVs, microwaves, radios. I'm not 100% sure what we have here in stock, because I can't see anything. Our prices, I hope, aren't too low. Check out this refrigerator, only $200. What about this microwave? Only $100. That's fair. I'm Ants-In My Eyes Johnson. Everything's black. I can't see a thing. And also, I can't feel anything either. Did I mention that? But that's not as catchy as having ants in your eyes. So that always goes, you know, off by the wayside. I can't feel. It's a very rare disease. All my nerves, they don't allow for the sensation of touch. So I never know what's going on. Am I standing, sitting? I don't know.
All right. So let's do spoilers for Ant-Man. So I guess let's talk about the post-credit scenes first.
Okay.
So there's 2 post-credit scenes to Ant-Man.
Mm-hmm.
The first of which has Hank Pym and Hope going down to the safe. Hank Pym opens the safe, shows the Wasp costume. Like, mm-hmm. says, like, oh, me and my wife were making this for her, but then we realized it was probably for you the whole time. And Hope looks at it and says, about damn time.
Yeah.
And that's accurate.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, it is about damn time. We're but also
have an awesome female character again, I hope.
Yeah. So I guess this movie ends with the promise that you will see Evangeline Lilly as the Wasp in a future movie.
Yes.
My question is, why wasn't that scene, like, halfway through the movie, and then she could have participated in the climax in some capacity? Like,
because this is Aunt Man, not Aunt Lady. I don't know why she's kind of just she's relegated to the 20-second clip at the end. I don't know why. I don't know why.
Like, and the post-credits scene's fine, but it's just like, I would really have liked to see her do something cool in the movie. Like, have her be an active member of the Ant-Man team.
Yeah.
You know? So that was a little annoying. I really liked Evangeline Lilly in the role, and I am eager to see her as the Wasp. But I would have liked to see her now, as opposed to the promise to see her in some movie in the future.
In maybe one of the next 10 Marvel movies or whatever.
I think, like, maybe Civil War she'll show up. But
maybe.
I feel like it's more likely we'll see her in Infinity War. I guess
Infinity War, probably.
Yeah. Because Ant-Man 2, if it happens, we'll probably not have him for a while.
That would be insane. If they make an Ant-Man 2.
I mean, like, if they do make an Ant-Man 2, like, it probably won't happen until after Infinity War. Like, that's... They've already got movies scheduled out to, like, 2019. Like, it's a very... And they've already pushed the schedule around to accommodate Spider-Man. So it's...
That's true.
So, you know, who knows? But
and they do mention Spider-Man, not by name.
There is a nice little Spider-Man shout out at the end of this movie where Michael Peña is having one of his montages, and the girl's like, "Oh, who do you want? We got this guy. We got this guy. We got a guy who can climb up walls."
Right.
Yeah.
It was awesome. Yeah. Yes.
Fun little Easter egg. And then the second post-credits scene.
Yes.
Is, from what I can gather, I think it's just a clip from Civil War.
Yeah, I just read when I got home after seeing it on Slash Film that Kevin Feige, I don't ever remember how to say his last name.
Feige, okay,
said that it is a scene from Civil War. It will just be, like, different takes or edited differently or whatever in Civil War.
Okay, yeah.
Like, he said they did that with Thor 2 or something. They've done this before where they show a scene or clip from a movie that's coming out already.
At the end of Iron Man 2, they show a clip from Thor.
That's what it was, yeah.
But the thing is, I feel like the clip from Thor was standalone enough. Like, that was... Because they set that clip up in the movie, in Iron Man 2. They had, like, Coulson leave for New Mexico to go find, like, an artifact. And then at the end of the movie, you see Coulson in New Mexico, and it's Thor's hammer in the ground. And that clip is in Thor, but it's set up enough in Iron Man 2 where it makes sense in Iron Man 2. I'm not sure the Civil War clip at the end of Ant-Man makes a whole lot of sense. It does sort of set it up. Because
a tiny bit?
The thing is, Anthony Mackie appears in this movie as the Falcon.
Yeah, which was awesome. That scene was great.
Yes, that was great. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But, you know, the scene is basically Captain America and Falcon have Bucky captured.
Mm-hmm.
And they discuss, like, some things and, you know, saying, like, "Oh, Stark, I don't know about Stark, you know, the Accords at all." They're like, Civil War stuff. And then, you know, they have to, like, pull off a job, and Falcon says, "I know a guy," implying that the guy he knows is Ant-Man.
Yes.
So there's that, but I feel like the movie doesn't really do enough to build to that, I guess. And, you know, there's a lot, this scene felt much more like out of context than the Thor clip did in Iron Man 2, I guess, is what I'm saying.
It felt like having what movie was it? That just came out a while ago. Oh, crap. That had the X-Men Days of Future Past.
Oh, Amazing Spider-Man 2 had the
Days
of Future Past flip,
Yeah. It felt, I mean, slightly less disjointed than that, but that type of thing where it seemed like this post-credit scene could have taken place during, like, because at the end of Ant-Man, Falcon is looking for Ant-Man, like, looking for him. So it feels like this post-credits scene took place already when the movie actually, I don't know, it was weird. But it's still cool. It was like, oh shit, that's Bucky when I saw that.
Yeah, like, it was neat to see, like, Captain America and Bucky and stuff. But yeah, we should talk about Anthony Mackie as the Falcon, because that's a really fun scene. In which Scott infiltrates the Avengers facility. As soon as he said, like, Yeah, as soon as like Hank Pym was like, oh, you know, they're checking out this facility in upstate New York, I was right. like, oh, upstate New York, that's where they said the Avengers thing was the Age of Ultron.
Right.
So that's probably what that is. And then it was.
And it was. It was really cool, though. I like that.
Yeah, yeah, that was fun. And, you know, seeing Scott, like, interact with one of the Avengers mm-hmm. was pretty cool. And, you know, we discussed in our Ultron review how Marvel movies have reached a point where characters can kind of just come in and out at their leisure.
Yeah.
Just due to how expansive this universe has become. And I think this is a great example of that. Like, Anthony Mackie can show up as the Falcon for a scene, and it feels totally natural. Like, it feels right, you know?
Yeah. And I like the recognition that the characters have for other characters in the universe. Like, there's the scene when Hank Pym is kind of explaining the plan to Scott, and he's like, well, the first thing we should do is call the Avengers. It's like, that's awesome. Like, like we've kind of hit this point, like we said, in the universe where everybody could just reference everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was great.
Yeah, because the Avengers are like, their exploits are worldwide news. Like, that's like...
They're literally gods.
one of them literally is.
One of them is literally a god, yeah. which is awesome.
Yeah.
So I like, and then afterwards, when he, you know, survives and he says, so how about that time I fought an Avenger and lived? It's like really cool. So I'm glad that that kind of thing is happening. Like you said too, that it's awesome to have a small stakes Marvel movie and to have those small stakes reference the larger and be aware of the larger stuff is cool.
Yes. Yeah. And, this movie also, connects Hank Pym into I guess S.H.I.E.L.D. was what that was at the beginning. With Hayley Atwell reprising her role as Agent Carter, and John Slattery reprising his role as Howard Stark.
Howard Stark, yeah. Which is cool, because I wasn't like... talk about CGI Michael Douglas. That was awesome.
Yeah. He looked like he just walked off the set of Romancing the Stone.
Right, like, I know. Because the opening, you know, the intro of this movie is 1989.
Yeah.
And it's him, you know, resigning. And it's like, I was like, wasn't really paying attention first, like wasn't looking well, and I was like, wait a second, what? And then I realized it's CGI young Michael Douglas.
Yeah, super, super weird, but super cool.
Very uncanny valley.
Yeah. I thought that scene was kind of odd, just because it was a de-aged CGI Michael Douglas interacting with old-age makeup with Hayley Atwell.
Yeah.
Which I thought was kind of funny. But, yeah, and I think this movie takes pains to connect Pym to Stark. In mm-hmm. a way, and you see that later in the movie, like we were talking about referencing other things that happen, like the rest of this universe, but like Hank Pym's like, you know, I spent my entire life trying to get this formula out of Stark's hands, like I'm not going to give it to another one, which is why they're not calling it the Avengers.
Right. That was cool. Was John Slattery always Howard Stark?
He was Howard Stark in Iron Man 2.
Right, I know there's like a picture of him at some point.
Well, no, he has like a scene in Iron Man 2 where, like, Tony finds, like, an old video of him and Howard Stark, like, has something.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
But Dominic Cooper usually plays Howard Stark. Thing is, Howard Stark usually appears... he appears in Captain America,
mm-hmm.
And he was in the Agent Carter TV show. And so, basically, Dominic Cooper is playing, like, 1940s Howard Stark.
Young Howard Stark.
Yeah, and John Slattery is playing, like, 1980s Howard Stark.
Right. Fair enough.
Dominic Cooper is going to grow up to be John Slattery, is the idea.
That's what that means. Good for that guy.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's it was a little distracting, just because it was, like, two different actors playing the same character.
Right.
Because I've gotten used to Dominic Cooper playing him at this point.
Yeah, I mean, if they went through the effort to age Hayley Atwell, they could have done it.
They could have aged Dominic Cooper, yeah. But
whatever.
Like, they already had an older Howard Stark, I guess, so.
I guess, yeah.
You know, it's whatever. Whatever. Let's talk about the Quantum Realm.
Yeah.
Because that was nuts.
That was freaking awesome.
Yeah, so...
It reminded me of Inside Out when they go into the abstract thought thing. I was just like, oh, yeah. two movies that came out recently that deal with things we can't show. Like, okay, cool.
Yeah, I mean, so the Quantum Realm is essentially where you disappear to when you go subatomic in the suit.
Yes.
And this is what happened to Janet Van Dyne, Hank Pym's wife and Hope's mother. She accompanied him on missions as the Wasp. And during a mission to stop a missile from, like, hitting a country or whatever, she went subatomic to go inside and stop the missile. But she got lost and disappeared inside the Quantum Realm.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what haunts Hank Pym throughout the movie. That's why he won't let Hope put on the Wasp costume, that whole thing. And here's the thing. Scott travels to the Quantum Realm during the film's final battle.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you can sort of see that coming from a mile away once they mention the Quantum Realm. But I think it's unlike anything in any Marvel movie.
It was very experimental, which was awesome.
Yeah, it's totally nuts. It is literally the ending of 2001 A Space Odyssey. Like,
holy crap, you're so... Yeah, you're right.
It's totally nuts. There's even, like, the shots of, like, his eyes, like, matching the same shots as Keir Douglas' eyes in 2001.
Right. Wow, I didn't realize that. That's awesome.
Yeah, so visually, the whole sequence was great. I mean, so, like, colorful and so different, oddball, and so, like...
I thought there was going to be a moment where it was going to connect to maybe the Tesseract, like some weird dimensional thing I thought was going to happen.
Yeah.
Just because the way, like, how Marvel movies work. I thought they were going to throw something like that at us in that sequence. And maybe they did, maybe I just didn't notice it. But it was... kind of glad that they did. Like, I like the contained Ant-Man thing that happened, that, like, is also happening in this movie.
Yes. And, you know, and Scott ends up getting out of the Quantum Realm and is able to, you know, survive. Which basically...
Motivates.
Motivates Hank to maybe figure, like, learn more about it. Like, Hank was obsessed with the Quantum Realm for a long time but never learned anything.
Right.
And now he knows that somebody can come back from the Quantum Realm, so there's a possibility that Janet's still alive. Which I think is...
And now he's okay with letting his daughter be the Wasp, because he can come back from it.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, this basically is... If they make it in Ant-Man 2, I think that's basically where they're going to go with it, is finding Janet in the Quantum Realm. I feel like that's got to be... Like, it's basically the setup for the sequel, if they make one.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's cool. I think it's a cool way... That's an interesting thing for the sequel to tackle, if that's what they do.
If that's what's happening. Yeah, I mean, when he's shrinking and he's, like, going past, like, the atoms, like, and going into like, that was bizarre. Yeah. I don't know.
They never show Janet Van Dyne's face. At least I'm pretty sure they don't. So, like, there's a family photo where her face...
I think there's a family...
Face is, like, obscured by a hat.
Right.
And so, what I read that was, like... They may want to use that character later on, and so they haven't cast her yet, so they just decided to cover her face, whatever like that. So, you know, there's possibilities for the future. And also, the final battle of this movie takes place inside a little girl's bedroom.
Yep.
And it allows for some of the movie's most creative visuals and jokes. The Thomas the Tank Engine thing was inspired.
Amazing. Inspiring.
You know, I thought that was great. You know, just... Like, the cut, I mean, this was in the trailers, but the cut where, like, you know, the train's, like, about to run over Yellow Jacket, and then it cuts away, and it just...
It just tips over.
Yeah, it just tips over, like, the movie's treating it like this big epic fight, and then you see it from, like, the girl's perspective, and it's just, like, you know, her toys are, like, falling down.
It's awesome.
Yeah, there's another shot where, like, somebody, like, tosses a fire truck somewhere, and it, like, kind of just lands gently on the floor.
Yep. The way that the size stuff is visualized is awesome.
Yeah. And then they enlarge the Thomas the Tank Engine, and it, like, bursts through this...
Goes through the house.
Yeah. And he enlarges a giant ant. He enlarges an ant. Yep. And, like, it runs out. You know, there's a lot of good... Actually, Hank Pym enlarging a tank and driving it out of the top of the building is... It's exactly why I love these movies. Like, that's the entire reason I go. For stuff like that. Like, that's...
Chekhov's tank, because Scott picks up the... They make a thing to, like, they show the tank keychain pretty often.
Yeah, they do.
Not often, but a few times.
Yeah.
So that was cool.
Yes. And so, so many creative visuals and jokes. Just watching Scott... Like, when he first gets the suit, he's in the bathtub, and, like, you see the water rushing in on him. He, like, falls down into the next floor, and he's, like, at, like, a disco, and, like, people are, like, stopping on him all over the place. It's great. It's a lot of fun to watch, and it creates, like, a whole new... It gives you, like, a whole new perspective of, like, these various everyday occurrences, I guess.
Yeah. Did you see the... I just saw an article about the Easter egg in that scene. When he lands on the taxi or the car.
Yeah, it's Garrett Morris.
Yep, who was the first live-action Ant-Man.
Yeah, in a Saturday Night Live sketch in 1979.
Yeah.
If you've never seen that sketch, it's pretty good.
Yeah, I'll have to watch that after we finish recording this.
Yeah, it's like a 10-minute sketch. It's kind of long, but there's like Gary Morris comes in as Ant-Man. It's called Superhero
Party.
That's
so cool that's included.
Yeah, it's called Superhero Party, and it's like a bunch of superheroes going over to Lois Lane's house for a party. Because Margo Kidder, who played Lois Lane in the original Superman movie, was the host of that episode.
Oh, okay.
And so they're all going to, like, all the superheroes going to Lois Lane's house for a party, and Ant-Man shows up, and everyone just makes fun of him.
Which is great.
Yeah. So, all right, I think, is there anything else you want to talk about Ant-Man before we wrap up, Mike?
No, I don't think so. I think that's it.
All right, well, then I guess we can wrap that up. So I think we both enjoyed the movie.
Yeah.
Very great deal. And so people should go see it. You know, it's Marvel. It's a general stamp of quality at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So, Mike, where can we find you online this week?
Find me on twitter.com/mdfilmblog.
Yes, you can find me at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog and all my writing and podcasts at filmbook.com. Thank you for listening to Film Bookcast. If you're listening to this podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to our podcast, rate it, take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email. We produce so many different ones per month. We'd love to hear from you. We're going to be taking a bit of a break because I'll be on vacation for the next week or so. But join us for the next episode of The Complete Works, where Mike and I will discuss Nicolas Cage's first collaboration with his uncle in Francis Ford Coppola's Rumblefish. And also check out the next Film Bookcast, where Mike and I will be reviewing the new Marvel reboot over at Fox, Fantastic Four. And Mike, so are you excited for Fantastic Four?
Yes. it looks cool, but it kind of just looks like superhero movie. Like, I don't know. I just saw the new trailer that, you know, they updated it or whatever. And there's the one line where he's like, oh, he's stronger than any of us, but he's not stronger than all of us. I was like, what? Shut up. Like, I don't know. It'll probably be cool. Like, I like the... Yeah. New cast looks awesome.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty big wild card for the summer. You know, I liked Chronicle, which is Josh Trank's previous movie.
Right.
And so I think, you know, there's talent there. Josh Trank is pretty good. The cast is really good.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm open to it. I think it should be... I think it looks different than a lot of what Marvel is putting out. So I think it's at least interesting on that front.
I just don't know if I want another... Well, I don't know if this is happening... But I saw they did an Entertainment Weekly spread or whatever with the cast of Fantastic Four, X-Men Apocalypse, and Deadpool. And it's like, I don't want
another universe.
Another universe, yeah. Especially that I don't really care about.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I'm not sure if Fantastic Four is supposed to be in that universe. Because that's the thing. If Fox is trying to do their own Marvel universe, the only characters they have are X-Men and Fantastic Four.
Okay.
And here's the problem with that, is that...
All of those are in the Avengers.
Well, not even that. I mean, the problem with that is that X-Men and Fantastic Four are the two most polar opposite groups because Fantastic Four, their groups are, like, those characters are universally beloved by people. Like, in the comics and in the previous movies, at least, those characters
and
are seen...
And they're mutants.
...are seen as heroes, essentially. Like, I mean, not really. They weren't born with their powers, so I don't think they're considered mutants.
Okay.
I think it's a distinction in a lot of the Marvel universe. Actually, truth be told, the mutant distinction is, like, ridiculous. So X-Men, I love X-Men. I think X-Men's great.
Yeah.
And if you take X-Men, like, on their own, like, the mutant thing is a great analogy for, like, civil rights. Any oppressed people,
right.
You know, the mutant thing where everybody hates mutants, it's a great analogy. Right. Problem is, the X-Men exist in the Marvel Universe, where superheroes with powers are beloved.
Right.
You know, people love, like, Spider-Man and, like, Fantastic Four and all them. Mm-hmm. And so it makes absolutely zero sense...
that they would be hated.
That the X-Men would be hated. Because the X-Men are born with their powers and other people are given them, I guess. But even then, like, I'm sure I can think of other characters who are born with powers that aren't considered mutants. Like Thor.
Right. Right.
You know, or... You know, I mean...
Anybody.
Yeah. Vision, for example, is form of powers, that kind of thing. But there are other characters that I can think of that are not off the top of my head right now.
Yeah.
But
that you could find.
Yeah. Or, like, I'm reading, like, I'm reading Spider-Man Renew Your Vows right now. It's a great comic, by the way. And he has a daughter in that comic who was born with spider powers. And she's not considered a mutant. She's just considered superpowered.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's weird stuff like that. Like, why are the mutants hated when everyone else is beloved? And the X-Men work best when they're kind of on their own. So I think combining X-Men with Fantastic Four in particular, who are known as, like, superhero celebrities, would be just a really dumb idea.
In my opinion. Yeah, I don't know if that's what they're doing or not, but...
I mean, they're already, they're expanding the X-Men universe. I know that much, because, like, Deadpool's happening.
Yeah.
And Gambit's going to be happening. And those will all kind of exist in the same universe.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
But, I don't know, Fantastic Four, I feel like, should just be on its own. If Marvel can't have them, then they should just be on their own.
Then nobody can have them.
Exactly, yeah. All right, so we will be talking about Fantastic Four.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We're doing another podcast.
We will be talking about Fantastic Four at some point, and we'll possibly also be talking about Mission Impossible Rogue Nation.
Yeah.
Which I'm very excited about. You know, I think that's going to be really good. Just seeing the behind-the-scenes looks at Tom Cruise hanging off the side of that plane.
Strapped to a plane.
Just giving me chills, man. I'm so excited. I'm so excited. All right.
Yeah, that looks awesome.
Yeah. All right, guys. Thank you so much for listening to Film Bookcast. We are out. I kind of want to do Mission Impossible.
Yeah. I'm going to see it either way.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe we can do like a combo review of like Mission Impossible and Fantastic Four.
And Fantastic Four. Okay.
That'd be crazy. That'd be radical. But
that'd be out of control. Some might even say we've gone rogue.
Yeah. You know, for a series of impossible missions, they seem to pull them off pretty easily.
Yeah. Well, let's save all those shitty jokes for Adam.